Okay, our next speaker is, I would say, an excellent member of nationalism. Please welcome to the stage, Peter Rushton.
Thank you very much, Paul, and thanks very much to everyone at this excellent venue for putting this event together and for bringing us together here today. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to begin with what might seem a simple question. Do we, as racial nationalists, do we sincerely want to win?
Yes.
Now,
that might not be quite such a straightforward question as it appears, because it over the years, those who've put that question might easily launch into what's been a false division of our movement over the years, or what I see as a false division of our movement over the years, between so-called hardliners versus so-called pragmatists. The populists versus the extremists, or whatever, however you might want to put it, in different ways, this false dichotomy has presented itself in our movement over the years. Because in fact, this question, do we sincerely want to win, has, I believe, two elements to it. Wanting to win does not simply mean electoral pragmatism. Sincerely wanting to win, so far as I'm concerned, does not mean merely saying or writing whatever gets most likes on Facebook.
Yeah.
Or even, you know, perhaps I'm being too ambitious in wanting likes on Facebook. Merely saying or writing what allows you to survive on Facebook, what allows you to survive on YouTube or Twitter nowadays, with all of these new social media being cracked down on and closed down all around us. Sincerely wanting to win doesn't necessarily mean even whatever saying whatever's necessary to win most votes, because by winning I don't mean winning support electorally or otherwise at any price. Just as unity in our movement doesn't mean unity at any price. Because, ladies and gentlemen, ask yourselves why the now rather misnamed United Kingdom Independence Party, UKIP, why did UKIP fade away so quickly from what seemed to be a very substantial electoral base? Why did UKIP collapse so quickly? Why did the momentum apparently fade so quickly behind the 2016 Brexit referendum? Not saying that that momentum has gone completely. As we mentioned earlier on, the seeds of hope from that success, from the success of UKIP, from the success of the referendum, from the success some years earlier of the BNP, which it's no coincidence occurred in many cases in the same parts of the country, the 2016 referendum, you could plot a graph on it on the wall behind me of the strong votes in that 2016 referendum and see time and time and time again those were places where that had been a focus of resistance to the One World Order, a focus of resistance to the fake order of the fake nation states based on multiculturalism and multiracialism, the fake patriotism of the Tory party. The focus of resistance to that had been in the same places where time and time again people voted for Brexit in 2016. But nevertheless, although those seeds of hope are still there and need nurturing, for the time being, as we'll see on May the 3rd, that potential will not be, in most places in the country, reflected even in candidates standing, let alone candidates getting elected in most of the country. So ask ourselves, why has that momentum faded? Why did UKIP collapse so quickly? And I would answer it this way. Because the superficial level of electoral support, that level of support that showed the potential that was there, was never deepened into a more profound ideological commitment. That in most of the country, that potential was never realised. The necessary investment of time and determination was never put in by movements like UKIP, or even, dare I say, by the leadership of the BNP in the early 21st century. The party was simply not interested, or significant people in the party at that time were simply not interested in putting the effort in to deepen, to turn a voter into a member, turn a member into an activist, turn an activist into somebody with a deep ideological commitment to our cause. Now, too often, parties and movements have been happy to take someone's check and then simply move on to taking the next check, which, of course, has led to this phenomenon in our movement that's been referred to sometimes as, in terms of superficial success, it's been summed up sometimes as the taps being turned on. So apparent success, new members being generated, but at the end, the other end of the bath, the plug was out. So you had this churn of people coming in, but nothing building. Yeah. Now, rather than so simply moving on to the new superficial level of recruitment, rather than taking that next step, that next essential step of building an educated and committed activist base. And it's no coincidence that I stress the word education, because, ladies and gentlemen, our movement is not simply having to create education for our benefit, not simply because we need an educated and committed activist base to sustain our movement, but because we are having to step in and fill the gap created by the traitors in Westminster and Whitehall who have destroyed an educational system throughout the length and breadth of our land. We are not simply... our movement in the broadest sense is now the repository, is now the guardian of traditional educational values. And that education, not only in Britain but across the white world, across Europe and across the European world, the great European diaspora, that education represents, comprises the values that we inherited from thousands of years ago, the values we inherited from ancient Greece. Those Hellenic values that in modern Europe, 21st century Europe, are now thoroughly corrupted and undermined by laws that set out not to sustain our people, not to guard our future generations, but to undermine our people and undermine those future generations. Laws in modern Europe that deny, for example, the right, one of the most fundamental rights of all, the right to exercise sceptical inquiry, sceptical scientific and historical inquiry, without which there is no progress, without which there is no true knowledge. If you're not... That is our precious inheritance from ancient Greece, our precious heritage that we are allowed to question, that without that right to question, there is no knowledge worth having. There is no real knowledge if you're not allowed to question it. It's not handed down on tablets of stone. It's there to be questioned. It's there to be refined. So, sincerely wanting to win doesn't mean selling out, because any victories won by means of selling out on those ancient values. Any victories won on that basis, ladies and gentlemen, would not be worth winning. The only problem, though, with talking about no sellout, no surrender, all the rest of it, is that some in our movement, some nationalists, might take that as a signal from this platform, or as a signal from some of us, that they therefore have the excuse of self-indulgence. And let's be quite clear. Ideological commitment does not mean self-indulgence. It means the opposite of self-indulgence. It means a serious commitment to wanting to win, not for ourselves, but for our entire community. So not selling out does not mean a license, for example, for what's sometimes called, for want of a better phrase, in our movement, Hollywood Nazism. Dressing up for the cameras, whether in a literal sense or simply dressing up your ideas in a way that appeals to a tiny subculture. Because we do not speak merely for a tiny subculture. We should be seeking to speak, as our opening speaker here today said, for people who might misguidedly, at some time in their lives, have embraced the values of our opponents, but who deep down, because they care just as much as we care, however misguided they may have been in the short term, the vast majority of them care just as much as we care about our heritage, about their children, about their grandchildren, about the area that's safeguarding the both the physical and cultural environment that they're growing up in. They care about that as well, and we would be committing the most horrendous crime against our people and the most horrendous actual betrayal of our values if, in the name of those values, we allowed ourselves simply to parade around as the representatives of a subculture. We represent the true culture of these islands, the true culture of this continent, the true culture of our race, not some marginalised subculture. And let's never forget that. So it's not about a subculture, it's not about Facebook likes. We need to remember that wider audience, to remember it's not about a fan club. It's not about a subculture. It's not about, in political or factional terms as well, it's not about the self-indulgence of deciding that we'll only speak to people who were on the right side in the split of 1979, or the split of 1982, or the split of 1986, or the split of 2002, or however many splits there might have been. At least, you know, the Christians might think they've got problems, but at least they've only had one or two splits compared to us, you know. It's not they might have had some split at the great schism about which way the priest ought to face or such things. And so let us not as a movement emulate those people who chose to fight each other over which way the priest should face, or in our case, to fight each other over which way we should have faced politically in some split of 35 years ago. It's about which way we face today in speaking to our people, and which way we want our nation to face. We face the future boldly. That's which way we face. We don't face each other in some mindless repetition of earlier splits. We look to the future. We look to a future boldly in defence of the true interests of our people, not the interests of some tiny faction or some tiny splinter of a splinter of a splinter. And what are those essential values, then, that we represent? Sum it up in under three headings: identity, sovereignty, and, in the sense in which we can sometimes define ourselves by saying what we are not, resistance to liberalism, both in its deleterious economic effects and its deleterious social effects. Those three things: identity, sovereignty, resistance to liberalism. Identity is quite simple. It's about thinking with your blood. It's about recognizing that the blood that flows in your veins is the fundamental of your identity, and that this can be represented, its outward form, if you like, can be represented in the nation state. It can be represented in feeling a sense of loyalty to your hometown, or to your county, or to your region. But fundamentally, it's about knowing who you are. It's about the fact that we sincerely believe, not just as a slogan, as Prime Minister May used it, but we sincerely believe that if you think that you're a citizen of the world, if you think you belong to the simply to the world, you're actually a citizen of nowhere. You actually belong nowhere. Our roots, our cultural roots, our family roots, our racial roots are what this movement is all about. And we should be seeking to link the political values of our movement to all of those cultural signifiers of identity up and down the country. Now that could mean, I could think of a relative of someone in the audience today who appears to, and this person in London appears to believe that we as the English have no real cultural identity, and that our culture and that the cultural identity of London is best summed up by the Notting Hill Carnival. What a tragedy, ladies and gentlemen, what a tragedy that there are people up and down our country who've been brought up to think that way. And we as nationalists should be seeking every opportunity to redirect people to the wellsprings of our culture up and down this country in any number of different traditions. It doesn't matter if it's Morris dancing. It doesn't matter if it's the Whit Friday marches in parts of Lancashire. It doesn't matter if it's the traditional well-dressing ceremonies in parts of Derbyshire, where people celebrate one of the most essential things of life, a clean water supply. All of these traditions that have grown up to based in the most fundamental natural forms of identity, that the ties of blood and place and culture, these are absolutely fundamental, and let our movement at every opportunity tie itself, link itself to those feelings of identity. In its constitutional format, that identity translates itself into sovereignty. And what should sovereignty mean to us as a movement? It should not mean simply the pound or the euro in your pocket. Sovereignty is not just about having the Queen's head on a banknote rather than whatever ghastly symbol the European Parliament might want to put on a banknote. No doubt in due course Winnie Mandela or something on a banknote. It's sovereignty is not simply about the pound in your pocket. It's not simply about the outward forms of constitution, because even if and when, and sadly it is still an if and when we do actually leave the European Union, sovereignty, ladies and gentlemen, won't mean very much if we're a United Kingdom with a blue passport, but the realities of our economic policy are still dictated to us by the same people who dictate policies to the central bank in Frankfurt, effectively dictate policies to a nominally independent Bank of England. What sort of sovereignty is that? Sovereignty will not mean very much if immigration policies are dictated to a nominally independent United Kingdom in exactly the same way as they're dictated to the European Union. And let's remember, that the so-called United Kingdom Independence Party was happy to proclaim itself as a pro-immigration party. Mm. Repeatedly the leaders of that party have proclaimed themselves as pro-immigration, and some of them even campaigned in 2016 in cities like Bradford, in cities like Manchester. They campaigned among the people who owned curry houses there and said, if we leave the European Union, we'll be able to stop these dreadful Europeans coming over to England, and we can have more Indians and more Pakistanis. You people in the curry houses, once we're out of the European Union, can invite more Indians along. Is that a sovereignty worth having, ladies and gentlemen?
No.
Is that the sovereignty that people in Stoke-on-Trent voted for?
No.
Is that the sovereignty that people in Oldham voted for? Is that what people in Sunderland voted for? All those places in Bradford voted for? Well, some of the curry owners in Bradford might have voted for it, but the type of people that were the backbone of successive nationalist movements, successive patriotic movements up and down the country, when they voted for Brexit, and some people on council estates in Preston that I know of, who, unless they happen to have a nationalist candidate, had never even bothered to vote, but on that day in 2016 flooded to the polling stations because they thought they were being given a chance, finally being given a chance to speak out for the interests of their family and speak out for the and what they were speaking on was not a constitutional nicety. What they were speaking on was not some visceral hostility to our fellow Europeans. It was about having the chance finally to speak on the question on which they'd been denied a voice by successive governments and down the decades since the now newly famous Empire Windrush, that they'd never been given, from the days of the Empire Windrush to 2016, they'd never been given a chance to speak on that fundamental question of immigration, and they believed 2016 was a chance finally to speak on that question of immigration, and they spoke resoundingly, and that voice is still echoing down the corridors of Whitehall and Westminster, and there's still, even as we speak, even as we meet here today, doubtless the people in Westminster and Whitehall are trying to find some way of weaseling out. Not simply about constitutions, it was about sovereignty. And of course, on the most fundamental issue of all in relation to sovereignty, i.e. whether the people of this one, on what issues the people of this country, the young men and now increasingly young women of this country, are instructed that they must go and risk their lives for, sovereignty, ladies and gentlemen, isn't worth very much at all if, even once we've left the European Union, the young men and women of this country are sent to fight, potentially to die and to kill, potentially in some cases not only to risk their own lives, but what in many cases is worse than that, to risk their own honour by fighting in illegal wars in the interests of in alien interests, when the orders passed down from on high to Downing Street that are then translated into orders to the British Armed Forces. If sovereignty means anything at all, it means that our people are only sent into the front line to fight for the interests of this country, for our interests, for their interests, for their children's interests, not for some alien interests dreamed up in Tel Aviv or Washington. And in resisting such threats to sovereignty, we also, third heading, we resist liberalism. This toxic doctrine that has meant the undermining of the economic structure of our country and the moral fibre of this country, and indeed ultimately the very racial basis of this country. It's been said, I've said in a couple of speeches over the years, and I was rather surprised to see that Dr. Matthew Goodwin, the anti-racist's favourite academic and author of books on the BNP and UKIP, said recently in a tweet, when there was talk of a new political party, when some people with three brackets around their names who've donated a lot of money to the Labour Party over the years were saying they were thinking of donating money to a new party, a new centre party. Dr. Goodwin, very honest, commendable honesty, said the real gap in the political market in this country is not the sort of politics these people are talking about, which is effectively some sort of combination of social and economic liberalism. Those are the values that have actually dominated for most of the post-war period, or certainly since the increasingly since the 1960s and 1970s, have dominated all the established political parties. They don't need a new party to reflect social and economic liberalism. That's what already dominates the parties there. Yeah. The gap in the political market today, the real gap in the political market, that Dr. Goodwin said if a party could set up that actually contested both of those issues, a party that was both socially and economically illiberal, or is resisting social and economic liberalism, that's the party that would clean up. That's the party that would answer a demand that's not yet being met. And what do I mean by that? Social liberalism, this idea that not only that anything goes in terms of personal morality, but that anybody can come and go regardless of their roots, that we become not only a world controlled by rootless cosmopolitans, but a world built in the image of rootless cosmopolitans, that we should all become rootless cosmopolitans. That's what social liberalism means. That our identity should somehow be washed away, that nationality simply means what passport you carry, has nothing to do with who your parents or grandparents or great-grandparents were. Social liberalism, the colourblind society, social liberalism, that we simply shouldn't care if our children and grandchildren are the only white kids in their class at school. That simply we shouldn't care because that's the way the world is. Toxic social liberalism is accompanied and is in some ways the necessary accompaniment to toxic economic liberalism. There should be no trade borders. Part of the purpose of immigration is that if a company wants to employ people at the cheapest possible rate, they should be able simply to import them from the other side of the world. And who cares about the effect of that in their community? Who cares about the effect on wages? I'll tell you who certainly doesn't care. The trade unions of this country no longer care about what the effect of immigration is on people's wages. What have any of the trade unions of this country done in the last few decades to speak out against the catastrophic impact of mass immigration on wages and working conditions up and down this country? And here in this town of Blackpool, we can reflect on the fact that this town grew out of, I was mentioning to friends earlier today, this town grew because industrial workers in this country were for the first time given paid holidays. And this town and others like it grew up as coastal resorts to answer that need for somewhere for people to spend their 1 week's paid holiday a year. Who were these people that were for the first time being given the luxury of a paid holiday? These men and women represented the very sinews of the British Empire. These were the men and women who worked in the engine room of that British Empire, the greatest empire that the world has ever seen. And yet the social and economic liberals would tell us, and those people, even loosely attached to our own movement, who offer a counsel of despair, those people who've given up, would say that the descendants of those first generations of people to get holidays in Blackpool, descendants of those people who had slaved away cotton mills of Lancashire, woolen mills of Yorkshire, potbacks of Stoke-on-Trent and the potteries, here in Blackpool had the luxury of their 1 week a year of respite from that slaving to build the British Empire. The Liberals and the cynics and those who are in despair would tell us that the descendants of those people have become so weak, so degenerate, that they're now incapable of defending their communities, incapable of defending their families, incapable of standing up for their race and nation. Now, we here today, if we say anything at all here today, if any message at all comes out from this meeting here today to those who are watching us online, is that we say, never. The descendants of those people, the descendants of the people who built the mightiest empire the world has ever seen, have not become weak and decadent. They are prepared to stand up and defy their political masters in the 2016 referendum. That potential of defiance is out there. That spirit is out there. And what a united nationalist movement means is offering a voice for those people. A voice for the natural order of things. Because the Multiculti Brigade, much as they might like to portray themselves as the voice of humanity, the Multiculti Brigade do not speak for humanity, do not speak for decency, do not speak for 21st century society. The Multiculti Brigade are the anti-social. Not just the anti-national, but the anti-social, the anti-natural, the anti-human. Let us, ladies and gentlemen, go forth from this meeting today as confident that we represent not only the true voice of our nation, not only the true voice of Europe, but that we as racial nationalists represent the true voice of nature itself. We represent the natural order of society. Let us not have any fear of going out and confronting those who would imprison us, those who would marginalise us, those who would even kill us. Let us have no fear in confronting those people and saying, we speak for Britain. Thank you very much.
Peter. Absolutely fantastic. Another round of applause, please. Peter Russell. That was fantastic to watch. Absolutely brilliant. Okay then. Right. We're going to take a little break because currently we might want to toilet or tea. I think the tea is on the go. Just before we do, we've got a couple of minutes. We've got Richard coming up. It's Richard from Blackpool. Give him a round of applause. Come on, Richard.
Anyway, thank you very much for allowing me to speak here today. It's basically that what we need is a united nationalist movement to fight our traitors in Westminster and our traitors on the street. the time has come, regardless to our differences, we must not fight each other. The days of fighting each other have now gone. And it's time to rise up for the British people of this nation, once and for all. And I am totally fed up of all these things getting the publicity, like the Stephen Lawrence Day. What about a day for Lee Rigby, Gavin Holcroft, Chris Donnell and Sharlon Downs? No, they won't do it because the politicians, the social workers and the police are frightened of the big scare word, which is known as racist. Well, that big scare word does not scare me. So, we need to build the movement to represent the people of this nation. Someone says to me, how many people think like me? I will say 30 million, but they daren't speak out because they are frightened. So the days of being frightened has now gone and it's time to unite and fight. Thank you very much.
If you're sick of hearing the anti-white message, then you've come to the right place. You're listening to Radio Ariane at RadioArian.com.